File 44. Chapter 8. The beginning of my political activity. Towards the end of November, I returned to Munich. I went to the depot of my regiment, which was now in the hands of soldiers' councils. As the whole administration was quite repulsive to me, I decided to leave it as soon as I possibly could. With my faithful war comrade Ernst Schmidt, I came to Traunstein and remained there until the camp was broken up. In March 1919, we were back again in Munich. The situation there could not last as it was. It tended irresistibly to a further extension of the revolution. Eisner's death served only to hasten this development and finally led to the dictatorship of the councils, or, to put it more correctly, to a Jewish hegemony, which turned out to be transitory, but which was the original aim of those who had contrived the revolution. At that juncture, innumerable plans took shape in my mind. I spent whole days pondering on the problem of what could be done. But unfortunately, every project had to give way before the hard fact that I was quite unknown, and therefore did not even have the first prerequisite necessary for effective action. Later on, I shall explain the reasons why I could not decide to join any of the parties then in existence. As the new Soviet revolution began to run its course in Munich, my first activities drew upon me the ill will of the Central Council. In the early morning of April the 27th, 1919, I was to have been arrested, but the three fellows who came to arrest me did not have the courage to face my rifle and withdrew just as they had arrived. A few days after the liberation of Munich, I was ordered to appear before the inquiry commission, which had been set up in the 2nd Infantry Regiment for the purpose of watching revolutionary activities. That was my first incursion into the more or less political field. After another few weeks, I received orders to attend a course of lectures which were being given to members of the army. This course was meant to inculcate certain fundamental principles on which the soldier could base his political ideas. For me, the advantage of this organization was that it gave me a chance of meeting fellow soldiers who were of the same way of thinking, and with whom I could discuss the actual situation. We were all more or less firmly convinced that Germany could not be saved from imminent disaster by those who had participated in the November treachery, that is to say, the Centre and the Social Democrats, and also that the so-called bourgeois national group could not make good the damage that had been done, even if they had the best intentions. They lacked a number of requisites without which such a task could never be successfully undertaken. The years that followed have justified the opinions which we held at that time. In our small circle, we discussed the project of forming a new party. The leading ideas which we then proposed were the same as those which were carried into effect afterwards, when the German Labour Party was founded. The name of the new movement which was to be founded should be such that, of itself, it would appeal to the mass of the people, for all our efforts would turn out vain and useless if this condition were lacking. And that was the reason why we chose the name Social Revolutionary Party, particularly because the social principles of our new organization were indeed revolutionary. But there was also a more fundamental reason. The attention which I had given to economic problems during my earlier years was more or less confined to considerations arising directly out of the social problem. Subsequently, this outlook broadened as I came to study the German policy of the Triple Alliance. This policy was very largely the result of an erroneous valuation of the economic situation, together with a confused notion as to the basis on which the future subsistence of the German people could be guaranteed. All these ideas were based on the principle that capital is exclusively the product of labour, and that, just like labour, it was subject to all the factors which can hinder or promote human activity. Hence, from the national standpoint, the significance of capital depended on the greatness and freedom and power of the state, that is to say, of the nation, and that it is this dependence alone which leads capital to promote the interests of the state and the nation from the instinct of self-preservation and for the sake of its own development. On such principles, the attitude of the state towards capital would be comparatively simple and clear. Its only object would be to make sure that capital remained subservient to the state and did not allocate to itself the right to dominate national interests. Thus, it could confine its activities within the two following limits. On the one side, to assure a vital and independent system of national economy, and on the other, to safeguard the social rights of the workers. Previously, I did not recognize with adequate clearness the difference between capital, which is purely the product of creative labor, and the existence and nature of capital, which is exclusively the result of financial speculation. Here, I needed an impulse to set my mind thinking in this direction, but that impulse had hitherto been lacking. The requisite impulse now came from one of the men who delivered lectures in the course I have already mentioned. This was Gottfried Feder. For the first time in my life, I heard a discussion which dealt with the principles of stock exchange capital and capital which was used for loan activities. After hearing the first lecture delivered by Feder, the idea immediately came into my head that I had now found a way to one of the most essential prerequisites for the founding of a new party. To my mind, Feder's merit consisted in the ruthless and trenchant way in which he described the double character of the capital engaged in stock exchange and loan transaction, laying bare the fact that this capital is ever and always dependent on the payment of interest. In fundamental questions, his statements were so full of common sense that those who criticized him did not deny that, au fond, his ideas were sound, but they doubted whether it be possible to put these ideas into practice. To me, this seemed the strongest point in Feder's teaching, though others considered it a weak point. It is not the business of him who lays down a theoretical program to explain the various ways in which something can be put into practice. His task is to deal with the problem as such, and therefore he has to look to the end rather than the means. The important question is whether an idea is fundamentally right or not. The question of whether or not it may be difficult to carry it out in practice is quite another matter. When a man whose task it is to lay down the principles of a program or policy begins to busy himself with the questions as to whether it is expedient and practical, instead of confining himself to the statement of the absolute truth, his work will cease to be a guiding star to those who are looking about for light and leading, and will become merely a recipe for everyday life. The man who lays down the program of a movement must consider only the goal. It is for the political leader to point out the way in which that goal may be reached. The thoughts of the former will, therefore, be determined by those truths that are everlasting, whereas the activity of the latter must always be guided by taking practical account of the circumstances under which those truths have to be carried into effect. The greatness of the one will depend on the absolute truth of his idea, considered in the abstract, whereas that of the other will depend on whether or not he correctly judges the given realities and how they may be utilized under the guidance of the truths established by the former. The test of greatness, as applied to a political leader, is the success of his plans and his enterprises, which means his ability to reach the goal for which he sets out, whereas the final goal set up by the political philosopher can never be reached. For human thought may grasp truths and picture ends which it sees like clear crystal, though such ends can never be completely fulfilled, because human nature is weak and imperfect. The more an idea is correct in the abstract, and therefore all the more powerful, the smaller is the possibility of putting it into practice, at least as far as this latter depends on human beings. The significance of a political philosopher does not depend on the practical success of the plans he lays down, but rather on their absolute truth and the influence they exert on the progress of mankind. If it were otherwise, the founders of religions could not be considered as the greatest men who have ever lived, because their moral aims will never be completely or even approximately carried out in practice. Even that religion which is called the religion of love is really no more than a faint reflex of the will of its sublime founder. But its significance lies in the orientation which it endeavored to give to human civilization and human virtue and morals. This very wide difference between the functions of a political philosopher and a practical political leader is the reason why the qualifications necessary for both functions are scarcely ever found associated in the same person. This applies especially to the so-called successful politician of the smaller kind, whose activity is indeed hardly more than practicing the art of doing the possible, as Bismarck modestly defined the art of politics in general. If such a politician resolutely avoids great ideas, his success will be all the easier to attain. It will be attained more expeditiously, and frequently will be more tangible. By reason of this very fact, however, such success is doomed to futility, and sometimes does not even survive the death of its author. Generally speaking, the work of politicians is without significance for the following generation, because their temporary success was based on the expediency of avoiding all really great decisive problems and ideas, which would be valid also for future generations.